This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
The Cubby House is a podcast about three cubs and their experiences in their local and global bear community.
This podcast is intended for mature audiences and may contain coarse language, adult themes, sex references, drug references, and listener discretion is advised.
Also, this week we'll be covering some emotionally challenging content. Extra discretion is advised. The Gay and Lesbian Switchboard is waiting for your call 24/7. Call them on 1-800-184-527. That's 1-800-184-527.
Welcome to the Cubby House, show number 28. This week we've got Kevin, and for those who may remember, welcome back, Jack.
I don't even remember myself. It's been a long time since I've last been on this programming, and who are you?
I'm Kevin. You remember me.
You're not part of this show.
Yes, I am. Well, I am now.
Where am I? This isn't the Dungeon Studios. I am frankly confused. And a little turned on, but mostly confused. What's going on with this podcast? I leave it to you for months, and this is what happens. What's going on?
It's called an upgrade.
He says that. Meanwhile, the sling hasn't been put up, there's no lube lying around, and none of the toys that he usually has lying around are anywhere to be seen.
So it is an upgrade. Cha-ching!
Va-va-va-voom! Just means they've got places to go now.
At any rate, Jack's back! Woohoo! Just Jack in 2010. At any rate, it's good to be back. I mean, I've missed this show. It's been quite a part of me, and not being part of it has just been gnawing away at me from the edges for quite a while. But unfortunately, the reason why I left wasn't necessarily in the most fortunate of circumstances. In the meantime, I think we've got a fairly good show lined up for you this week. In this episode, episode number 28 of the Cubby House podcast, we'll be learning about finding a new normal. That's our topic this week, finding a new normal.
But what's normal?
I think in this case, we meant normal as in a baseline mediocrity, as opposed to trying to tell us, you know, in any one of the three of us that we would be classified as normal. Yeah,
but no. I'll be explaining finding a new normal in a little bit, but what do we have coming up in this week's program?
Well, we do have, we have Raymond, who came in and did an interview with us about his artwork and how he's portrayed that concept, finding a new normal, in a lot of his artwork and the research he's done into his pieces.
Also, I'll be telling you why love is the drug you're thinking of.
And finally, we've also got a bit of a tribute to someone who both Jack and I have seen as many years as a father figure in mentoring, particularly in the means of radio and in other aspects of our lives as well. So we'll be doing a bit of a touch on that towards the end of the show.
It's a tender, touchy-feely episode of the Cubby House podcast. All that and more coming up on episode number 28, Finding a New Normal. All right, finding a new normal. When you do encounter something that shakes up your life quite considerably, things like a death of a family member or a divorce or losing a partner or moving to a different country and experiencing culture shock, things can be quite challenging. When you go through something that's quite shocking, life doesn't stop for you and it doesn't stop for anyone. And when you go through a life-changing experience, you may just wish for everything to come to a halt. But no, the world keeps on turning. People go to work, hop on the train, come home, just as they always have. The garbage keeps on getting taken out every Thursday. Things just keep on clicking over. But you can't abstain from living. The best you can do is try to find a new way to live. To change, to acknowledge, and to move forward, and find a new sense of normal. And that is what the show is all about this week.
It's about learning to deal with and accept change that's not necessarily been part of your control.
For me, it's about, you know, reestablishing the baseline for what you choose or what sort of stresses you or not. I mean, it's really funny, but one of the exercises I did at a team building exercise one time was have a thermometer on what you defined stressed you. And you suddenly realize that, yeah, all these little day-to-day stresses that we let, you know, sort of become priority things that are important aren't really in the long term. So as far as new normal for me, it's about reestablishing your baseline for stress.
But finding a new normal is actually something that Raymond Lee actually introduced me to while I was reading for his new film, which he'll be talking about a bit later in the program. That is something that has personally resonated with me as an idea. As most of you know, or may not know, that I've been dealing with the fallout of my dad dying of terminal cancer. And it's been a long process, I'd certainly say that. Mind you, that my experience of finding a new normal would be quite different to a lot of other people, particularly in sudden situations, because when you're dealing with a terminal illness over a deep period of time, that a lot of the adjusting, a lot of the finding the new normal, it happens while the person is still alive, that it's a process of letting go. But I'll be talking a bit about that a bit later on down the track. But it's a process. It's an ongoing process. And because life doesn't stop, the world doesn't stop for us. We've just got to learn to adapt and be reflexive to our world. And that is what it means to find a new normal.
We've been talking this show about the term a new normal. In the Dungeon Studios, we welcome Raymond, a part-time screenwriter and producer, director of short films, most notable for his piece Cold Hands, aired at the Golden Wolves Film Festival in 2009 and shown last week in Sydney. Welcome, Raymond.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Now, I'd like to know, the film Cold Hands is one of your more known shorts. Firstly, what's the synopsis of those who haven't seen the film?
It's a little hard to describe, as personal pieces tend to be, but it's basically showing a person coming home to a possibly empty home and just how he's dealing with being on his own. Again, it's sort of hard to describe what actually happens because you've got to see it. You know, I'm not going to tell you everything about it like a storybook, but yeah, it's a person dealing with being home alone.
I'm assuming this is home alone after someone has passed away, so it's actually about having lost someone and how you deal with it afterwards?
Well, that's actually what is revealed during the run of the show.
Yep.
Okay. So that you don't know at the start and not towards the end, you realise he's not really talking to somebody else. It's just him still seeing that person there.
For somebody who has seen the film, it actually is written in such a way that you think that you're trying to retell a story that you might have gone through. So I'd just like to know, is it from past experiences that you wrote this, or is it actually pure fiction and just playing with the effects of having somebody off camera as part of the dialogue?
The story itself is fiction, but as with any writer, you do draw upon your own experiences in your life. While I must say I'm fortunate enough that I haven't lost a partner, and I don't envy people who have been in that situation, you can always draw upon times when you have lost somebody you've loved. Everybody's been in a situation like that, I'm sure. And draw upon the emotions and how you feel at the time, and just the little things that you often miss about them.
Was there anything in particular from the story that rung bells from your own heart?
Nothing that I actually got to use in this one specifically, because for me, when you look back at people you've lost in your past, it's not so much a physical tangibility, but other senses, smells and sounds and little things that you often don't, at the time you don't value. And after the passing, they're things that you recall. One of the saddest things I ever heard was an interview with a person who said it wasn't the fact they lost their partner, it was bit by bit them not smelling them on the pillow anymore. And that was the killer, because they didn't go when they died, they actually were going away piece by piece as bits of the scent left their bed.
I suppose everyone grieves in a different way. And for some people, it's that sensory ability to still sort of hold on and hold that tangible person as though they're still there.
Definitely. And people do need time to grieve in their own time. And it also relates to the nature of the actual incidents that bring upon this. But, you know, dealing with grief in different ways, for example, the death of a loved one is shocking. But then if it's a long-term illness where you know that the inevitable is going to happen for quite a period of time, they don't typically grieve in the same way. Reading up on this, apparently, because when the final end does come, unfortunately, or fortunately, as the case may be, the person has already been grieving for some period of time, and it can often be seen as a relief rather than the actual grief that you would expect someone to have during the death of a loved one.
Well, it's strange you mention that, because when I was doing a little bit of research myself and trying to understand this concept of a new normal, a lot of the references were coming back to dealing with like a change in lifestyle, such as a long-term illness, so dealing with having to accommodate that in your life. Mm-hmm. And I can imagine that it would be a relief that, you know, you kind of can get back to what you were used to, the normality of what you were used to, but now you're dealing with it in a completely different circumstance. And that kind of, again, it very much ties into that whole concept of a new normal, coming back to something you used to know, but redefining it.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And again, with people who have lost a partner, often you identify with people as a couple. Oh, that's Joe and Frank or whoever, you know. When one of them leaves, they're no longer part of that whole. They've now got to reestablish themselves as an individual. And that, again, is the new normal.
Strange you should talk about relationships because, Kevin, I believe you just are starting to redefine yourself as a sole person having come out of a relationship, correct?
Well, I suppose it was a long-term relationship in that it went for 3.5 years.
Anything more than 3 months is long-term.
I wouldn't say that, no.
You don't know me very well.
3.5 years. I actually moved to be closer to him as well. So it started off as a semi-long-term relationship. He was in Ringwood and I was in Geelong.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, as long distances I'm happy to go. Ended up moving to Melbourne and it got really, really intense. And as things sort of happen, as cycles go, it came to an end. But having to step out of that and then suddenly realize that, you know, there's all these things that you now have to do by yourself, that you don't have that support anymore. It's daunting, but it's also an incredible growth experience as well. You suddenly realize, oh, there are all these things that I used to like to do, and you sort of put them on the sideline because all this stuff just came up in the middle and sort of replaced it. And then when you're single, you suddenly have all this spare time. But it's funny, you don't really see how people perceive you as a couple until you aren't a couple anymore, because there are things that people won't say to you because, you know, you're with that person. And then when you're broken up, all of a sudden it's a case, oh no, this is actually what I was thinking.
Did you find it liberating to move away from and become your full self again?
Yeah, absolutely. I suddenly realized there was all these things that I put on hold and all these things I loved and that I just picked back up. And I went, wow, it was like rediscovering myself to a certain degree. Like all the things I love, it's like my photography. I suddenly have a lot more time and energy that I can put into that, and just small little things, I guess. It's being able to eat the food that you like, being able to cook. I rediscovered the fact that I love to cook, as I'm inflicting on everyone that, you know, dares to come inside. I'll cook for them and they have to eat it.
I know some people find things like having spare time, getting back into hobbies, cooking, for instance, can be enjoying, as you found, but some people I find take that up as a more of a challenge or a difficult hurdle to approach. And I'd like to ask you, Raymond, in your research in finding out how people redefine themselves, do you think there's a lot of people that have a lot of trouble adjusting to doing household skills such as cooking and reorganizing the house without, say, a long-term partner or a parent or something there?
Well, obviously, if you haven't had experience with that in the past, there's just the skills shortage there as far as, oh, I sound like a politician, as far as not being able to know what to do with day to day. As far as like dealing with the loss of a loved one, it's just a matter of reestablishing yourself back as being the whole individual, as you were saying before. I think the problem more so is that in the household context, which you've brought this up, is that everything in there is a reminder of the lost loved one. And that's very hard. It's some of the stages of dealing with grief and moving forward, which there are actually, one of the things I did do with my research is there is actually documented, not strict steps, but stages of dealing with grief. And this becomes part of it. For example, there's the Kubler-Ross model, which is commonly used. It defines 5 stages of dealing with grief. And part of this, you know, learning the new skills can be part of that. They cover, first of all, denial, anger, and then third, bargaining, fourth, depression, and then moving on to acceptance. And so often what is a matter of the fact is when dealing with individuals and meeting friends and friends you know who have recently gone through some sort of trauma, but they'll be somewhere through these stages of acceptance, of dealing with their grief, and also dealing with them at that time, realizing where they are is still healthy. So for example, the early stage denial, where they're going, you know, it's fine, it's good, I'm okay. Realizing that, you know, it's still early days. They're still going to deal with this. When they move on to anger, and they you'll come across people who are just furious. They've obviously lost something they've loved, and they're very just angry. And from that, you know, well, okay, this person's not angry at me. They're not angry at the world. It's just them still coming to terms with this, and it's working through this healthy sort of stage. They move on to their bargaining, and you know, what could they have done wrong? What could they have they done something wrong? You know, if they did this right or wrong, would that have changed the situation? And they start, you know, arguing with God, if they're that way inclined, or pointing fingers and blaming people around them. And it's just, again, it's them moving on and dealing with it emotionally as an emotional being. And eventually the depression hits in where it's, you know, it's gone. The loss has happened. It's not going to be changed. It's, you know, there's nothing I can do to rectify the situation. And you just let the natural emotion go and just, okay, let it go through you. Let it just deal with it. And then finally with your acceptance, you know, okay, so it's happened. I've dealt with it. I've allowed myself the time to recover from this. Let's move forward and find the new normal. You know, move forward to where we go from here sort of thing. It was interesting with writing that I actually had to sit down with my main characters and work out what stage they were at in themselves, so that as I was writing this Cold Hands, and also my new piece, which is yet to be named, sitting there with the characters and saying, okay, where are they? With my first film, definitely the person was around the denial stage. Mm-hmm. Still not accepting that they were on their own. With my new film that I'm working on, the person that's definitely gone past all that. They've gone, they're almost to the acceptance stage, but still not quite ready yet to admit that, you know, they've lost someone they really loved.
Okay.
Well, I mean, even in those forms of grief, like, there's not really a set checklist, as you said. It's just more a stage of you go through these stages, but there's nothing to stop individuals from going through those stages in their own ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, you may find that, you know, people will step back and then have to go back, you know, forward. So they may go back to the anger stage because they suddenly go through something that happens, because mm-hmm. not every grief is going to be the same, obviously.
No.
And while it's handy to have that sort of stage chart so you know how to deal with people and you know sort of what to expect when it's coming, it also comes down to an individual. You need to be able to just let that individual go through what they're going through and still... I mean, if you're really good friends with them, you're still the ones that sort of step up going, that's really unhealthy. You need to stop doing that.
I think at the end of the day, you've just got to be a friend and be there for them. It's well and good to tell them what they need, but a person needs to discover it for themselves.
But there are clearly defined lines of really unhealthy behaviour that can come out of grief as well.
Well, yeah, and that also comes down to cultural sensitivities and comes down to what the original normal was. Mm. I'm going to paint a picture here that a friend of mine from the scene lost his father, unfortunately, and he's from a Spanish background, and I went around to give my condolences. Mm. And the scene that I saw when I stepped to their home was his mother, who was an older lady, in a corner in a couch. There were 6 boxes of tissues around the woman, and every photo possible of this man was within 2 feet of her face. And she was literally ripping one tissue after the other. And for me, I looked at that and went, hang on, that's a bit, you know, that's not dealing with it. That's just feeding her depression. But that's culturally what they did for comfort. So it's sort of hard to come in and tell people what is right and what's wrong, but you've just got to play it by ear. And unfortunately, there is no hard and fast rule.
Hmm. And if I remember rightly, in some people's stages of grieving and whatnot, I think there was a study done at some stage that the difference between men and women and their different types of grieving, men will generally go to the gravesite of somebody they've lost by themselves, as opposed to a woman who will ask for someone to come with them and comfort them in that point of grieving. So there are going to be differences as to how people deal with their own cycle of grieving.
But is that necessarily because of the way if men and women deal differently with grief, or is that just because that as a man, I don't want to be seen to be grieving?
And it could be. It's again, like you said, it's different cultural norms in that respect.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, one has to be very strong, but they should also have the opportunity to grieve. But a lot of guys might feel shame because they are getting to the point where they're crying or whatnot, or they're not seen to be strong. And that's why they might go off and do it on their own when they're not observed and they don't feel the guilt of being not so strong in the eyes of somebody else.
Yeah, but the thing is, even that sort of idea of masculinity and what it sort of entails is completely reversed or sort of questioned in the gay community.
Correct.
Because we question all those preconceived ideas that, you know, as men, we're not supposed to show our emotions. We're not supposed to be queenie or whatever it is you want to use, whatever term. We are more introverted about that. We think about what, you know, we can and cannot do. We don't let society tell us what we should be doing. So when it comes to grief, I suppose we do have a little bit more freedom than the normal heterosexual male, I should say, because we already are exploring our emotions and our freedom to be able to express that.
It's interesting you say that, because I'm actually just trying to think of a situation where I've actually seen another man grieve publicly. And I actually, as a public crier, I put my hand up, I'm a public crier. You don't often see it. You really don't. And I will admit, during the screening of my first film, I did see somebody cry in the audience. It showed that the piece that I made got the right emotional response. You know, I mean, I'd hate to have done this piece then had them laughing. Drama, good drama, deals with people only. And I look for what's, you know, what's the biggest emotions you can get, and it's either love or death. And the storylines that I do encompass both of those parts of the spectrum. By dealing with the death of a loved one, you get the joys and the highs of being with that person and having your lives intertwined and thoroughly just enjoying each other's company and being part of a whole. But then there's the tragedy of the death and dealing with the loss of half of you, basically, and reestablishing yourself as an individual.
When you were creating this piece, did you ever see it being used as an assistance tool to both help and explain how people deal with their own losses and learning to live without them?
As far as being a tool, I'm not too certain, but definitely showing and reflecting on how people, a person can deal with it, definitely as such. It's not something that gets a lot of discussion about because we tend to not want to dwell on the morbid parts of life, unless, of course, you go around in black with really pale makeup on and talk about how everyone hates you, because we do. It's more so about, you know, you don't want to talk about that, and sometimes you do need to stop. And as a man, go, you know, hey, dude, when it happens, I'll be here for you, you know? And I'm just hoping that, you know, when it happens to me, you guys can help me too. We live in a community which, in the past, has had to deal with a lot of death. Thank goodness, as long as we all keep practicing safe practices, we won't have to go back to that sort of stage where we do mourn almost a whole generation of people, but we have had to learn to deal with that. As a little sad note, one of the early times when I went to the lead, I met somebody who was campaigning for equal rights in marriage, but he was an older gentleman, and I sat down, had a drink with him, and it was really sad because he stopped at one point and just went and realised that every person he used to go to the bar with was dead, and he was the only one of his group of friends that was still alive. And it's really sad to think that, you know, his new normal was to be a survivor. And that's sad. And then that's why, again, we need to, A, make sure these things don't happen by doing the right thing, and B, be there for the people who have to afterwards.
Mm.
While we do need time to pause and grieve and remember the ones we've lost, we've got to remember life's also about living. You know, you will eventually cope with this. You will soon find your new normal, to reuse that phrase, to find your new now, and then move on and start loving life again, because that's what it's about. We've had a great solemn talk today about dealing with these sad topics, but we've got to remember life's for living. You've got to go out there and enjoy every moment you can, because you're not here forever. None of us are here forever. Make the most of it now.
Thank you very much to Raymond Lee, who kindly came in and talked to us about his latest pieces of art and his experiences with his research. If anything we've spoken about today brings up something that you want to talk about, please give the Gay and Lesbian Switchboard a call. The number is 1-800-184-527. That's 1-800-184-527. They have trained volunteers that will listen to you and give you more information as needed and point you on to more direct services if you feel that you need to get onto them.
There are volunteers waiting to receive your call right now. Cookie, how does it feel to be heartbroken? To be wretched? To be deeply broken in the heart area?
Yeah, it hurts. Quite simple. You're disappointed, you're hurt, and the first thing I go through is, what have I done wrong? I always self-inflict and say, where has this fallen on me that this has come to this? So, of course, you go through your own emotions. And this all can happen within a matter of moments to a matter of months.
What the hell is with all of you guys going through emotional things right now?
We're having a sharing bonding moment, Kevin. Ride the boat or get off.
I don't do strong emotions, and I definitely don't do sharing. This is bizarre, but all right.
I'm going to ignore you now.
Oh, yes, because that's different from your normal.
Cookie, what you're feeling is valid. And I'm going to tell you something which might seem very obvious to you, but also might prove to be somewhat of a relief, and a relief to anyone which is going through the aches and pains of heartache. And that is, it is all in your head. It is all in your head. Now, we do our research on the Cubby House podcast, and I've gone through the Journal of Neurophysiology, an article called Reward, Rejection, and Emotional Regulation Systems Associated with Rejection in Love. Yeah, it's a nice title. It's very, very dry.
Very clinical.
So what they did for this study is that they collected up a whole bunch of college students in the United States who were recently rejected in love, but they were aching in the heart, and they decided, let's scan your brain with a fMRI machine. And what they did is that they got these people and they got them to bring in a photograph of the person that they felt affectionate to, and a person that they had neutral feelings to, a person that doesn't invoke that sort of strong reaction. And they asked the people in the fMRI machine to think about their times with the beloved ones ex-beloved ones and the person that they had the neutral feelings towards. And they wanted to see how the brain lights up like Christmas. And what they found is that the crazy feelings that are associated with heartache is sort of like a chemical deprivation on the chemicals that are associated with love. For example, if you're Facebook stalking someone or Twitter stalking somebody, or if you keep on neurotically wondering what you've done wrong and how you're going to win them back, that is your brain acting to try and get its next fix of that lovely thing that you call love, you human people and your feeble emotions.
Hey, you're the one that wants to be all sherry lovey-dovey, remember?
And they found that the neurological reactions that are associated with grieving for a relationship is very much the same neurological reactions as a person coming off crack cocaine. Think about it, man.
Chocolate.
Crack cocaine.
That's a great pickup line. Hi, would you like to be my crack cocaine for the night?
This might explain why people act particularly crazy at the end of, if they're feeling rejected in love, why they might do desperate things or send regrettable messages via SMS, or why they might race into another relationship quite quickly, is that they're trying to fill that chemical gap. I know it sounds very impersonal. And,
or the opposite.
One of the things I concluded from this study is that romantic satisfaction can be seen more as a drive rather than a feeling, that it should be perhaps more associated with the wanting of sleep or the wanting of food. One of the things I actually concluded from this study is that likely your addiction to love eventually subsides and then you become a normal, regular person and you find your new normal.
I totally agree with you. As far as you know, you're at the dying end of your relationship and the love just isn't there and you have these drives to just do things that sort of, anything to make it sort of last a little bit longer, just get that one more hit. I think that's why a lot of relationships tend to stay way past the expiry date. Way past the expiry date when they should just be ended and finished and everything. But no, they're hanging on for that one more hit. And they just can't go through withdrawals.
If you're listening to this show right now and you're coming off the high of a relationship, let me just remind you that it's all in your head and eventually you'll stop craving for that person and you don't need a 12-step program for that.
There once was a man. His name was Adam Stobbs. Adam Stobbs was introduced, at least to me, as the person who showed me what radio was all about. Adam then became a good friend, and it wasn't just because he was a mentor, but he taught me a good couple of life lessons, and first of all through friends, and then directly. One of those ones was, it's okay if somebody's positive. Just because they're positive doesn't mean you have to discriminate against them. They are still humans too. And it was through that and through a good couple of friends, through the course I did, that I learned to grow and accept a lot of people for who they were, not for what they did. Adam used to do a show called Ligera Non Troppo, which was a very classical music-based show.
It was a classical music show.
Well, it was a classically music-based show. The music was classical. He was trained as a classic pianist and as a teacher, as that's what he was doing as far as a day job went. In the times that he actually came off the music and talked, it was a very magazine-based show. You talk about anything and everything. He got the term Adam Bitchy Stobbs because he was very direct and very upfront about some of the things that he talked about. He also had a very articulate way of trying to describe and approach topics. And I know one of the ones he played back for me many, many years ago was he was interviewing the father who just recently lost his son to cancer. And bitchy as he may have been called, not even he could have held back the tears of how this story came about. And unfortunately today, we now pay tribute to him because he too has now passed on. And this is our story of how we knew such a wonderful mentor, friend, and companion.
Adams Dobbs was certainly an institution within the Melbourne gay and lesbian community, that he may have not have always been the most liked person, but he was the most genuine person that you would probably meet. He was a person that would generally take interest in what you had to say. And I know that while I was having problems with my dad's illness, that he was... Whenever I encountered him, he was always asking questions about how I was, how things are going, and it was nice, actually. Adam Dobbs was a person that generally believed in what he did, that he was around our parent station, Joy 94.9, since it's pretty much its first inception, right on until his death in June 16, 2010, that he was very enthusiastic about what he did. He had a positive social conscience. He wanted to make the world a nicer place to be. Those are qualities that we should seek to embody within ourselves. And I know that I can learn upon him in both professional context as a radio presenter trying to create programming which is generally interesting and engaging to my audience while having a social conscience, but also being a good human being. And I think that is something that we can all take from that. Now, we've actually got some clips of Adam Dobbs.
Yes, the clip we have is when we invited him to our first debate. He was, believe it or not, the first speaker for our topic, Is Sex Better Than Food?
It was our first debate. We were so young.
Here he is in his portion of the debate.
Please welcome to the microphone Mr. Adam Bitchy Dobbs.
Thank you, Jack. I need a participant at some stage during my delivery tonight. I need somebody to come up and act as an audience member for Word Association. Jack, would you be so kind as when I tell you to go and get me an audience member? But I've got something I wanted to show you first, because I've got a little something here that I don't think you've seen before that I thought I might show you. Fat, none. Hair, none. What does that tell you? Sex, lots. Sorry, they told me I was going to have a lectern. I am a fucking professional after all. I just put my decks back up. Hello and thank you. It's nice to meet you all. For those of you who haven't had the pleasure, my name is Adam. I had a little look on the internet before I came here. Actually, I look on the internet a lot, but I actually looked at something with words this time and to find out some of the definitions of the things we're going to be debating en masse tonight. Food, for example, is any nourishing substance that is eaten, drunk, or otherwise taken into the body to sustain life, provide energy, or promote growth. How interesting is that? Sex, the definition of sex, genital contact, hello lesbians, especially frequent penile insertion. They must use plastic ones. Followed by orgasm, coitus and copulation. Not necessarily in that order. Okay, one fact I will concede. For life, some food is essential. Why is everybody at the Laird? Why is this such a popular place? Why do people come here? I met three of my life partners, monogamous ones, I'm going to be the only one for, out of the eight that I've been with, here. I met three of them here. Did they come here for food? No. Did any... Shut up.
Out the back. Yes. You've got time later for a...
It's my microphone. Now, let me tell you. Did you come here for...
Why are you calling a man lady? It's a lady man.
You see what happens when they haven't got an argument? Right? How good are we? Nobody came here for food. Did you come here for the sausage sizzle after, or the troughs of peanuts? No. You came here to get your sausage sizzled later and a different type of trough, I'm sure. Now listen, what are the health consequences of overindulgence of the two topics, food and sex? Let's look at the concept of the pig. as it relates to our topical debate. The common connection, in personal terms, between food and sex is the concept of the human pig. Gross overeaters are known as gluttonous pigs. People are often ashamed that they're gluttonous pigs, and they hide the fact that they sneak around with sackfuls of M&Ms and pockets stuffed with chipolatis. They eat to feel good because they can't feel good about themselves. The fatter they get, the worse they usually look. The worse they feel about themselves, they eat more, and then it just goes on and on and on. The concept of the sex pig is quite acceptable. The sex pig has good self-esteem, is creative, wait to see what's in here, thorough, interesting, and engaging, and makes everyone feel good. Well, maybe not my mother. If my mother knew what I did up in the place of many steps, she wouldn't feel so good. Most sex pigs are well experienced and have chronic overindulgence in sex. They are healthy, well adjusted, and some even have tongues like a boa constrictor or a boa constrictress.
So he can get the
but I don't have adjective hemorrhages. Could I have, Jack, you were going to arrange an audience member for me for a quick word association?
Anyone, just come up.
I just want to, all I'm going to do is you just have to call out a few words. I'm going to show you something, and I want to tell me the first thing that comes to your mind. Just call it out for everybody to see, just to prove a point. Okay? You don't have to do it. I'm not going to embarrass you.
I found a nice person in a service uniform.
Come along.
He felt like being conspicuous.
Okay, you don't need to come on the stage. Thank you. There's only room for me on the stage at the moment. Now, I want you to... I'm going to show you an item, and I want you to tell me what you think it should be used for. Should it be used for food or sex? And tell me how good it is.
Definitely sex.
Now, what were you just holding up there?
It was a cucumber.
Food.
Food? Would you use it for sex? No, you wouldn't. Hang on, I've got another one.
It's not thick enough. Not thick enough.
Not. Hang on, I've got more. It's just trying to fiddle around in my scrotum here. Ah, what about this?
Oh, sex, yeah.
Sex, yeah. You know what that is? Is that thick enough?
No.
Okay. See how quickly he identified most of the food items except one for sex. So what do we learn from that? Look at the parallels in art. Thank you.
You can go back to your seat now.
You were exceptionally articulate. Now, look at the parallels in art. There's not much in art to do with food. How many famous paintings do you see of food? None. But how much famous art is to do with sex? All of it. Okay. In all my life and most of our lives, we would have a lot less opportunity for sex than you have to consume food. You can consume food anytime. The opportunities for sex don't come so quickly. The fact that sex is something that is not constantly rammed down your throat or thrust in your face as a consumer on television tells us immediately that food is TV and it's not sex. Sex is better than food. Food is vile. Sex is good. Food is cancer and heart attack. Sex is a good exercise workout for your prostate. Last question, just to prove this point. Would you rather whack your snout in between two sesame seed buns and find a hot meat patty, or whack your snout in between two hairy buns and let your tongue find something much more interesting? Thank you.
Round of applause for Mr. Stobbs. Today's been a bit of a funny show, hasn't it? That we've been dealing with quite serious content, which is learning to live again. That's what finding a new normal is, that it's learning to adjust to living in the world when your world has changed.
The hardest thing in this world is to live in it. Which is from Buffy, and I thought a Buffy quote right then and there would not be appropriate.
so let's not go there.
I think it's a rather nice quote. But first, I wanted to tell you that if you've got someone that you hold dear, or even someone that you kind of like, just give them a hug. Go on. Do it. I dare ya.
See, you're eyeing them up right now.
Do it. Do it. Do
just
it.
Just a favor first, though, and, you know, pause the podcast. You know, we'll give you time now to just, you know, as Jack was saying,
randomly go and hug somebody.
Well, I guess we're at the end of another episode of the Kirby House podcast, aren't we, Kevin?
We certainly are. And it's been quite an enjoyable little journey, even though we've had to deal with those, you know, human emotion things that come out every now and then.
Do we think that we have found a new normal? At least for me, I know that this podcast will not be the same as it was before. Cue it. Kevin.
You're not Ryan.
Really? What gave it away that I wasn't Ryan?
I think about 40 kilos.
Oh, ouch.
We still love you, Ryan. Come back. We miss you, baby. but also we're experimenting with the show's format and trying to make it the best gosh darn program we can make it.
That's right. And I think finding a new normal is a great way to say we will be starting a new format come October, at least after I get back from America and I have my little ditty.
That's right. You're off to, you know, San Francisco, aren't you?
And Las Vegas, and meeting our sister podcast in Austin. So I'll be having a whole heap more show content next month from America. And then we'll be starting our revised Cubby House V2.
I like to party. I like to disco. I left my heart in San Francisco.
And from that, this is Show 28 from Cookie.
I'm Jack.
I'm Kevin.
And hope you enjoyed it. And we'll catch you from my American trip next podcast.
All that and more next week on the Cubby House podcast, episode number 29. How I learned to find peace in myself and learn to lick chocolate off a big furry man's belly. See you next week.
See ya.
For all our fans
and critics,
we'd love to hear your thoughts and ideas on things we've talked about on the podcast.
Even if it's just to tell us that we're idiots or that we're hot.
So you can either email us at podcast@thecubbyhouse.net.au
or check out our Facebook fan page, The Cubby House Horde.
Plus, keep an eye out for our relaunch logo, website and rebrand of the podcast coming in October.
More details at cubbyhouse.net.au.
Thanks for listening and we'll catch you next podcast.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.